You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 6th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Claudia Golden, professor of economics at Harvard University, author of Career and Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. Also on the program today, Omicron, spreading two times as fast in South Africa than Delta. The unanswered question, is it significantly less virulent? Meanwhile, in this country, Delta still rages. Upstate New York hospitals overwhelmed. New York City imposes a private employee mandate. Meanwhile, CNN fires disgraced brother of disgraced former Governor Cuomo, disgraced Chris Cuomo. Parents of a Michigan shooter are apprehended in Detroit. U.S. intelligence agencies claim that Russian troops are amassing on the Ukrainian border and preparing for a potential invasion. Biden to institute diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Olympics. Former colonel of the D.C. National Guard publicly claims that the army generals who testified to Congress about the January 6th response lied. Lastly, Afghanistan, facing starvation for about half of its population. Over 20 million people facing starvation at this very moment. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Glad you could make it today. I want to talk about just briefly what's going on in Afghanistan in a moment. But joining me, as always, on this Monday, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you today?
I'm okay. Beginning of the week. I can feel the end of the year break coming. And I now, Hanukkah is behind me. Thanksgiving's behind me. This is one of the big benefits. I mean, there's probably others.
Right.
But to me, one of the things I really like about being Jewish is that, like, I'm done.
Oh, yeah.
I'm done. I don't even recognize, as far as I'm concerned, the next holiday, New Year's.
Well, I mean,
and I don't even really recognize that one either because that's amateur hour.
I hate New Year's. Probably one of the worst. Easter's worse, but New Year's is terrible. I don't like Easter. Anyway, it's like a little too religious for me, and I'm not religious at all. But, I mean, what happens when Hanukkah, it changes every year, is closer to Christmas? Is that when you're less grateful for being Jewish?
It drags it out a little bit, but it usually is over before Christmas happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's been one year that I remember in the past decade or so. And, you know, it's about, you know, the kids, and it's just I'm done. I'm done. Like I can mentally check out. I've done. I bought all the presents I need to buy. You know,
I can understand that. That's nice.
Yeah, I try to have no friends who celebrate Christmas.
Mm.
And
makes sense.
And I get all the gifts. You know, during Hanukkah for the in-laws. Still send them kids gifts, but that's easy because that's just, you know,
yeah,
pictures of the kid on a mug, and that's it. You've wrapped it all up. And they love that.
Wow. I'm surprised you didn't even lean into my my anticipated excuse, which is supply chain.
Supply chain's big. That's, I mean, of course, that's operative.
That is kind of a gift this holiday season, truly, is
yep.
The supply chain excuse.
Exactly. All that said, We do have a new scarf available on the Majority Report merch site, and also pencils.
Ooh, scarf.
Pencils are coming. New normal pencils and pens are coming in the next day or two. Check for that. But we got
a good scarf.
Well, a good wool scarf with a tiny little logo, so it's you can wear it.
Mm.
And my sister told me to mention that, so I just did.
Good work.
Yep. Thank you. I want to talk about what's going on in Afghanistan briefly. Afghanistan's economy is facing collapse. And there's a situation. I mean, and to a large extent, if you look at the, not all, but so many of situations where you have famine in a country or a region is a function of not the lack of food, but the lack of an ability to distribute food or a functioning society that can distribute food. And that seems to be what's going on in Afghanistan. You have almost 23 million people who are facing potentially life-threatening food, lack of food. And it is... And the problem appears to be essentially a function of like the collapse of the Afghani government, the freeze on the assets that we have and that the world has on Afghanistan. You have civil servants who have gone weeks, maybe in some instances months without pay. You have there's no money in the banks, so people can't withdraw money. There's no cash that's circulating in the economy, which apparently is some measure driving up prices of food.
How much of that had to do also with some of the Afghanistan officials that were close to the United States leaving with a bunch of money?
I'm sure everything that has taken place there, including, you know, our failure to set up some type of, you know, durable and sustainable society that was functioning there. We did the same thing. I mean, let's put it this way. The way that we trained the Afghan military was to be completely reliant on the presence of the U.S. military. There is no reason to believe that we didn't do the same thing with all of the civil institutions that we had a hand in developing, that there was always a sort of predicated on this notion that, that, you know, that we would be there. Now, no country is an island, particularly a country like Afghanistan that is going to need outside investment, is going to need outside aid, just simply because it's been, you know, just obliterated over the course of the past 50 years, at least. And so we need to provide aid, and we need to provide liquidity through, you know, these, whatever it is, the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. We need to get cash in there.
We
cash
need to pay reparations.
To
I mean, that's how you can phrase it. The Afghan people need reparations from the United States for the 20-year occupation and the amount of bloodshed that we've that we're directly responsible for, and the subsequent destabilization.
Yep. So that's just something to keep in mind. It won't get much attention in the news, I imagine. But we, you know, this is the implications of our 20-year occupation.
Afghanistan, the withdrawal was all over the news. CNN, everybody couldn't stop talking about Afghanistan, right?
Right, of course.
Now,
everyone was very concerned.
Everyone was so concerned for the fate of women in Afghanistan, of people in Afghanistan, if we were to withdraw. Not so loud right now.
No. Nope. Meanwhile, we've got we're in the wake of people sort of, you know, coming to the realization that that it's more than likely the right for a woman or a trans man for that matter to have sovereignty over their own body and decide whether they want to terminate a pregnancy is gravely threatened. It's either going to happen, you know, sometime in June, like a total wipeout of Roe v. Wade or pretty close. And so there's awareness of what's going on, and you have the right sort of like, you know, there's really two responses from the right. One is to sort of downplay. We saw like Ben Shapiro say this the other day. You can go to Mexico and get an abortion. We're not outlying it in the entire world. And those are the people who are, you know, concerned about the, or maybe don't have as narrow of a constituency where they feel like they have to justify this thing as not being draconian.
They have to downplay the consequences of their like religious theocracy that they're trying to implement as so that they can do it, because it's not it, when you talk about what actually is going to happen, not that popular.
Right. Or the other part of the conservative movement is full on embracing the theocratic nature of this. And here is sort of like, you know, Tate Reeves, who's sort of somewhere in between. He doesn't have to fully embrace it as long as he says the right words to trigger these things. And then we'll show you another Republican politician who is all in on that. Here's Jake Tapper talking with Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves. Of course, it's the Mississippi case that the Supreme Court is looking at. This one drops the date in which a woman has a right to get a pregnancy from 15 weeks out from, to end a pregnancy, to get an abortion, 15 weeks out from conception, which of course is a full-on assault at Roe v. Wade. And once you decide that we can just make up whatever the date is, it will ultimately be if you have sex, you just will have no right to end a pregnancy. You need to suffer the consequences of your actions.
Morning after pills, those also will likely be under assault, because if life begins at conception, please.
Right.
You can't, as soon as you have sex and that results in the pregnancy, you better not try to mitigate that.
Let God take care of this. Here is Tate Reeves.
Is that a yes, that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, you will enforce the almost total abortion ban in Mississippi that exists in the inevitability or in the situation where Roe v. Wade is overturned? Yes?
Yeah, Jake, that is a yes, because if you believe, as I believe very strongly, that innocent unborn child in the mother's womb is, in fact, a child, the most important word when we talk about unborn children is not unborn, but it's children. And so, yes, I will do everything I can to protect the lives of those children.
So
now that's why, if you wonder why they say innocent unborn children in the womb, and they say the most important thing that we say is not unborn, but it's children. Now, they use the word children, but of course, this is not a child. It's a fetus or an embryo.
Or, you know, to the point where a law like Texas is trying to limit, like the one in Texas is trying to limit abortion. It's an electrical pulse, basically.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is that a person is someone who is born. A citizen is born. A child is born.
Yeah, a life is born. And I say, when did my life start? Only like a right-wing ideologue would say at conception.
Right. Well, I mean, but did it really start at conception, or did it really, I mean, what is conception? I mean, did it start when your mom started to ovulate? Before the egg was seeded, right? I mean, there is an egg there that you ultimately became you. And there is a sperm that ultimately became you. And what is the process of developing that egg and that sperm? I mean,
when that's up for debate, okay, then there's no limit to the end to what the states can determine, which they're all hiding this behind states' rights.
And then be clear here. If this is a person inside this other person who has equal rights to the person who is carrying them, in many respects, their rights are actually trump the rights of the mother.
Yes.
Why?
This is an attack on female personhood is how it should be framed.
Yes, indeed. Because if you as a who is carrying an embryo, maintaining a pregnancy, your rights become subservient. If your life is threatened, or just simply in terms of, like, you can go down just to, I don't know, nutrition. I mean, all throughout the scale, you are secondary. And you don't need me to tell you this. Here is a Republican congressman who's going to make it quite clear. Why do I have a, hold on. Well, why do I have a cup here to hold my drink? If I didn't have a drink, the cup is useless. This cup, this vessel for the drink, it's the drink that is primary. Here is Madison Cawthorn making it clear how they perceive women who are pregnant.
Madam Speaker, imagine you've just walked out of this chamber and outside is a gorgeous sunset. You have a Polaroid camera and you snap a beautiful picture and the great photo prints out the front. You hold it and shake it, waiting for the picture to appear. But suddenly someone walks by and snatches your photo, ripping it to shreds. You're stunned. You cry, "Why did you destroy my picture?" The person replies, "Oh, it wasn't a picture. It wasn't fully developed yet." All of us in this room realize how insane that reasoning is.
I'll tell you something. The hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone into arguing to strip a woman's right to choose, and that's what they come up with?
Yeah, he's just like, I mean, I'm not sure if he's heard of digital cameras. But.
Well, I mean, but forget about it. Even on the terms of his own Polaroid, it's not a picture yet.
It literally isn't.
That's why you're waiting to find out how it comes out. You don't know what it's going to be. It could be nothing.
Yeah, sometimes it's trash and then you rip it up.
Exactly. You have no idea. But also, the other thing is that holding it in your hand does not have the implications for your hand that carrying a pregnancy the term does.
Also, is the abortion doctor the one that comes and rips the picture out of your hand and tears it up without you, I guess, carrying that?
Yeah, I mean, is he describing a forcible abortion?
The agency here is all messed up.
Yeah, right. The photographer, the one who took the Polaroid, would be presumably the picture ripper upper, but regardless.
But that's the best they can do. But let's go on, because what he's about to do is reveal exactly what the role of the person who is pregnant plays in all this.
The person replies, "Oh, it wasn't a picture. It wasn't fully developed yet." All of us in this room realize how asinine that reasoning is. That photo was transforming into a beautiful image. This illustration by Seth Gruber is simple, but it's what our nation has done to the most precious image of all, the image of God.
There we go.
Madam Speaker, a silent genocide has slipped beneath the conscience of America. Precious works of our Creator, formed and set apart, meet death before they breathed life.
What?
Eternal souls woven into earthen vessels, sanctified by Almighty God and endowed with the miracle of life, are denied their birth by a nation that was born in freedom. God's breath of life blown away by the breath of man. This cruel and fallen world may seem too filthy for their very presence. But these precious temples are crafted in the image of God himself. One day, perhaps when science darkens the soul of the left, our nation will repent. But until then, the carnage of this unconscionable deed will stain the fabric of our nation. I hope that the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. I hope that we stop the genocide of abortion in this country. With that, I yield back.
I mean, I don't know. I think there's a clue in there when he says when they meet death before they breathe life. Mm. What? I thought that was a little contrary to what you were saying.
But to our point earlier, I mean, this is the actual language of the motivation behind the desire to limit abortion in this country. You can have public-facing people like Ben Shapiro, people with audiences that are different than the constituency of someone like Madison Cawthorn, who, again, I hate giving attention to because clearly, like, he relishes in it to a degree that I find frustrating. But why we play it is because this is how the evangelical base that is the driving force behind this effort, this is how they perceive women. I mean, I call myself an eternal vessel all the time, but many women that I know don't perceive of themselves that way. So they have the right to not think of themselves purely as eternal vessels for God's light or whatever the hell he says.
Eternal vessels, he says, sanctified by Almighty God, endowed with the miracle of life. Vessels. Eternal vessels. You're always a vessel. I mean, this is...
You're a vessel for my, like, not to, you're a vessel for my life-producing force.
There you go.
Right? Like, that is the inherent misogyny, too, behind this. Of course it is. But women are there to be a container for the all-powerful seed of me. And so, like, it's...
Primary that's, directive.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Adam and Eve, hello.
All right. Just a moment. We'll be talking to Claudia Golden, author of Career and Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. Meantime, a couple of sponsors. We're getting into that season, folks. Outdoors is calling, and you may want to answer. Backcountry.com is the place to go, because when you shop at backcountry.com, you can pick up the phone and talk gear with an actual former Olympian. It's founded by a former Olympic skier. Backcountry.com is the best place for outdoor gear and apparel. You get Patagonia, you get Yeti, you get Santa Cruz bicycles. Backcountry.com has thousands of your favorite brands and products for every outdoor adventure. It's nuts. Like, I'm, like, learning about new... I've learned about so many different new things that exist, and I'm not even quite sure what they are. Skate boots? I can't quite figure out. Like, there's also, like, ways you practice skiing on the off years, but...
I'm looking right now, because I have... my stepdad's really into outdoorsy things and dirt biking, and so with my uncle. Well...
Your stepdad does dirt biking?
Yes.
Dirt biking?
Dirt biking, yeah.
Like motorized dirt bikes?
Yeah, he's into it. And also, like, hiking and stuff, like, they really like those things. I mean, I can not understand the appeal, but anyway, I'm bookmarking this to get him a gift.
I'm not even... I don't want to pursue that.
I mean,
like a motorcycle dirt bike.
Yeah,
do jumps.
Maybe I'm not referring to it for this, like in the right way, but they go into the woods with the motorized bike. Because I don't know what to tell you.
All right. Well, the good thing is, last year at the beginning of January, I wanted to take the kids snowboarding upstate, but. I got there late. I assumed that people wouldn't be renting stuff and there was no stuff to rent. And then I was like, do I really want to go inside at that point? And the kids were nervous about it. So I rented stuff for Saul, but I bought for Mila because she has basically done growing.
Mm.
And I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I didn't have the ability to go into a place. I called up, spoke to the people there. I had... Mila's weight, I had her height, I had her shoe size, I had this, got completely set up, got her a board, got her boots, and she's set now, probably for years. Backcountry gearheads are experts, and they give you a masterclass in the great outdoors. They can provide you a detailed pack list for your next summit, hike, or you figure out what winter jacket works for you. You're in good hands. Everything Backcountry sells is of the highest quality, but the Backcountry gearheads are the real difference. This is the thing that makes it good. You're looking at there's so many like coats out there. Which one do I need for this type of weather? This is what I'm doing with it, et cetera, et cetera. Go to backcountry.com/majority. Enter promo code majority to get 15% off your first full price purchase. Some exclusions apply. Go right now. Get 15% off at backcountry.com/majority. Enter promo code majority. Backcountry.com/majority. Don't forget to enter the code majority. I got like one of those cool, I don't know how to pronounce it, cool jackets. I decided I wanted to get a warm coat last year because I was like...
Oh, that's the name of the brand.
I got to go out. Yeah. I got to go outside and, you know, that's where I'm going to eat or drink or whatever it is. And I finally got a real coat. And I called up and I was like, what's the one if I'm thinking that the temperature is going to be around? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be warm at like 10 degrees.
Yeah.
But I want it to be not too heavy. So, bingo.
I'm really am going to get these gifts. I'm looking
at it
right now.
We'll talk more about this whole motocross thing. I don't get it.
I don't either.
Folks, very easy to get dehydrated these days. For me, the heat comes on in my building. It is a very dry heat.
Got older that, like, building?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm feeling that too.
Way old. And so in addition to my morning regimen, where I drink a bunch of liquid IV, one stick of liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. So I have some when I go to bed too. Mm. Plus, liquid IV tastes great. Flavors like watermelon, strawberry, and lemon and lime. If you have a couple of drinks, holidays, want to make sure you don't feel like a total wreck the next morning, liquid IV before you go to bed. If you wake up, you forgot, you can take a liquid IV then.
It is really hard to cure a hangover, but you can prevent it, and liquid IV does help with that.
There you go. Emma came in today and was like, do we have any more Acai that I could maybe take home?
Yeah, I mean, yes. That's not what I needed.
We're out
all
of
the
Acai and strawberry.
I know.
I'm not saying that you were drinking. I'm just saying. I do love it.
I do love it.
Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. Healthier than sugary sports drinks. There's no artificial flavors or preservatives and less sugar than an apple. Has the optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium. Delivers water and nutrients to the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings during this COVID-19 era. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, to food banks, all around. You know my deal with liquid IV. I use the lemon ginger with the matcha. My energy drink, as it were, substitute for coffee. And then I follow up usually with, these days, with the orange, that is like the immune support, or the watermelon. Grab your favorite Liquid IV flavors nationwide at Walmart, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. It's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using the promo code MAJORITYREP, R-E-P, at liquidiv.com. And lastly, that's a good stocking stuffer, incidentally.
Oh, yeah.
Lastly, mouthwash has not changed in about 140 years. Basically, just water and alcohol. That's why the oral care experts at Quip created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need, and it comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that's 100% recyclable. So no more of those massive jugs that you get at the box stores or wherever it is. Now, you've heard me talk about Quip many, many times. I'm a little bit obsessed with dental hygiene. They make the electric toothbrush and the amazing different mechanisms of floss that you've heard me talk about in the past. Well, Quip mouthwash kills bad breath germs, helps prevent cavities, and of course, leaves you feeling fresh thanks to a formula that gives your mouth everything it needs. They have a 4-time concentrate that has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and, of course, the alcohol. With a customizable subscription, you can get refills automatically delivered straight to your door. You can do so every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch to the complete oral care routine. You pair it with Quip electric toothbrush. Both my kids and I have. They actually have some really cool-looking ones now that are like matte black. Ooh. That I've been thinking about. They have refillable flossers. That is one of the greatest inventions I think I've ever seen. I get too excited about that. And they have Quip's great-tasting, good-for-you gum that comes in that little Pez dispenser. In fact, I have it in my coat right now, I think. I love Quip. I really do. I mean, it's an amazing design company that decided to focus on oral hygiene, and it just makes it all my kids brush more and floss more because of it. And if you go to getquip.com/majority5 right now, you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-day dose, or I should say a 90-dose supply of Quip's 4-times concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. That's number 5. G-E-T-Q-U-I-P, getquip.com/majority5. Quip, it's the Good Habits Company. Okay, I want to welcome to the program Claudia Golden. She is professor of economics at Harvard University, author of Career in Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. And we have her. Claudia, thanks for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Claudia. Thanks so much for being here.
Let's start, I guess, where, you know, half your book is really a history of women's entry into the workforce. And we should say, though, right off, that this is you look exclusively at women who have graduated college.
That's right.
And let me just ask you in terms of an approach, like why do you measure inequality in that fashion?
Okay, so first of all, I'm not measuring inequality. I'm looking at how women over time have achieved career and family. That's not necessarily looking at inequality. That's looking at a transition.
Okay, and why specifically then in that regard, women who have graduated college as opposed to, even at this point, I guess the 60%, some odd more of women who have not?
Okay, so let's get the numbers straight. Today, among young women, around 45 to 50% will eventually graduate from a four-year institution in the U.S. So it's a large number today. It was much smaller in the past. But if we think about the term career, okay, a career is something that's different from a job. And the word career comes from the Latin root to mean to run a race. It's the same root that gives us the word chariot and the word carriage. And so if we think about what it takes to run that race, it's probably a fair dedication, a fair amount of education. And generally, it would be someone who graduated from college. Now, it may not be a four-year institution in the past. It may be a two-year institution, but it's something more than a high school degree.
Okay, fair enough. And so you cover essentially five groups of people, cohorts of women over the course, really, I guess, temporally. So let's look at just the first, which is women who graduated from college in essentially the first two decades of the 20th century.
Right.
What did you find in terms of like what they did in terms of their ability to develop a career?
So the first thing is that I take the last 120 years and I look at what happened to the individuals in terms of their marriage, children, labor force participation, and the types of careers that they entered. And they get divided up in a very, very natural way. These aren't boundaries that I impose on this group. These are boundaries that come from the group. And you can see it very clearly by the fact that the first group, group one, that graduated college in the first two decades of the 20th century had either family or career. So in that group, 50% of the women never had a birth or never adopted a child. That's enormously high. And we can contrast that to a group three that is as different from that group as night and day. So group three graduated college from the 1940s, the end of the 1940s to the mid 1960s. These are the mothers of the baby boom, not the baby boom themselves, but the mothers. In this group, of those who married, about 90% had children. So in fact, the boundaries here are coming from demographic changes. They're coming from essentially from a sea change that occurs in society. And we wind up with the most recent group that wants to have career and family.
Okay, so let's go from group one to group three. From the 20s to the, I guess, the mid-40s, essentially, there was a delay in family, right? Is that what you found, that in terms of, like, or I should say, having children?
So that's from group three to group four is where the big delay comes from. From group one to group three, it's just the opposite. Group one is marrying at relatively low rates, having small numbers, of a very small fraction are having kids. Group three is, as I said, the mothers of the baby boom. This is the huge demographic tides that led to very early marriage rates, even among college graduate women. And then there was a remarkable change that occurs in the late 60s, mainly early 70s, when the age at first marriage begins to climb and has continued to climb since then. And those women put off having kids, put off getting married, and pursued professional and graduate degrees and pursued careers to a very, very big extent. They put off having kids, and to some degree, a large fraction of them never had kids, you know, sort of like the Liechtenstein print, I forgot to have the kids. And the most recent group is looking back at them and saying, well, you did the career stuff right, but let's get the family stuff right.
Okay, so can you walk us through, as we transition from group one to group two to group three, like what and so on, like what are the changes that what's happening? Like, why is it, why we can look at the data and you've assessed for us, you know, sort of what took place, but what's the why there?
So let's talk about one of the biggest whys that we can really nail, which is the huge difference. So as I've described it, there are differences between these groups that are monumental, night and day. And so one of the biggest is between three and four. So group three is marrying really young. The median age at first marriage for that group, remember, graduating college up until the 60s, from the 1940s to the 60s, the median age at first marriage is like 23. That's ridiculously young. Then we move into group four, and they begin to put off getting married, put it off. At least for 3 to 5 years, so that they can nail the advanced degree and get the career. How could they do that? Very simple. A little pill. So the birth control pill, even though it's approved by the FDA for birth control in 1960, is not available for single women until they're is a large number of changes at the state level allowing women to obtain this prescription drug when they are single and when they are young. So that is a major league change, not just a change in science and drugs, but it changed a political change in terms of what we allow people to do.
Do you have a sense of if there was a change in desire? Like, I mean, if essentially we look at the pill as a technology that allows you to defer pregnancy, and then that option was chosen when it became available, essentially, widely available. Was there a change in disposition through those earlier years in which...
Let's go back and explore this a little bit more. It wasn't simply a change in the ability to put off pregnancy. It was a change in the fact that you didn't insure yourself and get pinned, lavaliered, engaged, so that just in case you got pregnant and we didn't have Roe, that you wouldn't have really major league problems. You'd be able to, everybody knew who the father of that child was. So once you start going down that slippery slope of having various, in some sense, insurance policies, you get married early. And so what the pill did was allowed young men and women not to have these insurance policies. And that meant that you got married later and later. And of course, you also had kids later and later.
No, but I guess what I'm asking is that, I mean, is the basic assumption that, that X number of women wanted to pursue a career from the early 1900s, and that that number was static, and their ability to do so was a function of technology, and then ultimately what that meant in terms of like their ability to either put off marriage or to get married or whatnot. That's what I'm asking first is like the.
Sure. So we can run, you know, if we could, we would take that group, that early group. I can identify many, many wonderful people in that group who didn't have all these options, but they didn't have a lot of other options either. The infant death rate was very high. Okay. Electricity in the home was less than it is today. Appliances were less. The degree to which there was child care was even worse. The degree to which social norms went drastically against the woman who worked and had young kids. So it isn't just taking those individuals and dosing them with the pill. We have to dose them with lots of other things. But it's my sense that the individuals were more the same than the environment was.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying, that the impetus to have a career was there, but there were other aspects of their context which would inhibit those desires, not just the actual sort of like, the real, the key that the pill ultimately ended up being. There were other contexts that were inhibiting that.
Right. I mean, there were what one might call a sea change in technology, technology in the home, in the office, you know, in terms of science and medications, many, many different things. But at the same time, it meant that the traditions and social norms that surround us also began to change. And there were laws. I mean, there were rules. I explained some of them, but there was also the case that up until the 1940s, school districts around the country did not allow married women to continue working. There were marriage bars. There were anti-nepotism bans. There were many, many different things that would have to be chipped away to allow us to catapult the women of the early 20th century to the early 21st century.
Will you tell us about those marriage bars? Because I found those fascinating. I mean, I feel like I had heard about them before, but it really I found surprising.
Right. So so school districts around the country, some more than others, had enforced marriage bans. So if you were a married woman, you often couldn't get a job teaching in a school district, especially if there were large numbers of single women who were willing to take the job. And if you were a teacher who was single and you got married, you would have to resign.
What was the theory behind that?
Well, I don't know if we would say a theory, but think of it as sort of supply demand. So let's say that you're a school district and you want workers, you want teachers who are very good and also relatively docile. You don't want them to be represented by their husbands. You don't want their husbands to come in and say, by the way, you're pushing my wife to work in certain hours when she shouldn't be, or her classes are too large. So that was one sense. I don't think we have a very good reason exactly why they existed, other than the fact that single women were far more docile and manipulable group of workers than married women were. In addition, there was a sense, and it was the case, that a married woman was going to get pregnant relatively soon, since this is in pre-modern contraceptive era. And so therefore, she was going to leave anyhow. You might as well get rid of her early.
Was there also the kind of notion, at least when being structured by the men here, or from their perspective, that the single women who were employed here were also looking for a husband, so it allows for a more amenable attitudes as opposed to married women who are already, they can't be the object of my affection?
There weren't that many guys making these decisions, though. I mean, so the question is, where are the men here? These are relatively small schools, so I don't think that there are. This isn't like an office in which there's, you know, a bunch of male supervisors.
Was there also an element of this is like some measure welfare that a single woman does not have any means in which to be supported, and so therefore they get prominence because society, you know, we don't want these single women running around starving type of thing.
Yeah. So there these regulations were greatly extended during the Great Depression, which would enhance the credibility of what you said. But the extensions were mainly in office work. And they always existed in teaching. And they were increased somewhat during the Great Depression in teaching, but not all that much. And let me also add that even though we are intrigued by this, and it's extremely interesting, and I would say it's extremely important, the data on this is extremely difficult to find. I used every single method to dig up information on what these school districts were doing, and it's extremely difficult to do. So this is yet again something that was important, and then once it disappears, it becomes sort of ephemera. So I also dug up information about what firms were doing from surveys that were done by the Women's Bureau of firms, and they're mainly during the Depression.
Interesting. And will you? I want to circle back to just, you know, the what you had to do to get all this data, because it's nuts. There is no like, this is the encyclopedia of all this stuff here. I mean, this is really sort of disparate stuff. But can you speak to what turns out to be somewhat of a myth that the increase in the participation of women in careers, I guess, was a function of World War II? Because, I mean, I think like for me, that was always sort of my assumption was that was a big turning point when, you know, women en masse joined the workforce. And that's not really accurate, is it?
No, it's certainly not accurate for careers, because the women during World War II were not being asked to become doctors and lawyers and managers and academics. They were being asked to type, and they were being asked to work in manufacturing, you know, often in clothing, hats, shoes, but in addition, in the more famous types of employment, such as shipyards and airplanes.
Well, did the inclusion of women in these jobs end up having any implications in terms of careers? I mean, it's, you know, was there a dynamic? I guess what I'm asking is, once you're on the inside of the factory, that maybe you have a chance to become like a manager, or once you're learning to type. Maybe the skills you have, you know, end up getting you. I mean, I don't know, you know, if you're going to college, it really seems to me to be a function of money, but there's still maybe more of an opportunity to have a career at that point.
Right. These were generally not college graduates. So the women who were, so this is, let me back up a bit and say that, yes, indeed, there was a very large increase in the employment of young women, particularly those who would not have entered the workplace because they had kids. We had the Lanham Act, which supported nursery schools in the 43 to 45 period. There were also older women. In fact, that's in fact the largest group that came in are women in their late 30s and in their 40s. But by and large, by 1950, the vast majority of the women who were brought in to the workplace went back into their homes. So many of the jobs that they took were jobs that returning servicemen, you know, that they were those jobs. And so these women were summarily dismissed. That said, we can trace the fact that even by 1950 in places where more women were brought into the workforce, we can see the residue of that. But it's not a career residue. It's a job residue.
Okay, so let's get to the more towards the present day.
Can I ask one more question before we move on from that? Just really quickly, like, how did you find in your research these this timeline fit along racial lines? Like, what were some of the discrepancies between white women and non-white women?
So this is, Emma, this is like extremely important, because whereas the propaganda to get women into the workforce in the 40s was enormous. I mean, one of the fun things is you can go to the National Archives and look at all of the posters. Okay, they're all white women. They're all middle-class women. These are the women who resisted going into the workforce at the time. These are the women who the government realized we needed to bring in. Black women, oh, they wanted to work at these jobs. These were jobs that they had been that had been segregated. These are jobs that Black women couldn't get. These were jobs from which they were essentially barred and banned. And so one of the most fascinating and interesting parts of women's work in World War II is the fact that Black women finally got a foot in the door of various manufacturing firms.
I want to come up to sort of present day on some level. And when you look at and there are some areas where women in terms of careers have more or less gained some equity, I guess is the right way to put it, in terms of men. But there's still a significant amount of couple inequity, I guess we would call it. And you attribute this to two things: the time bind, which is a function of greedy work. Will you explain those terms to us?
Sure. Absolutely. So greedy work, and I think that all of us have seen it, have experienced it. So work is greedy when, if you work a lot of hours or particular hours, if you jump when you're told to jump, you're actually getting more, not just in total, but per hour. So the individual who works at the big law firm who works 80 hours a week gets more than twice per hour than the individual who works at the boutique law firm and works 40 hours a week. So that's one very simple definition of greedy work. And the reason that it becomes important in terms of thinking about gender and couples is that if the family has caregiving responsibilities, it could be for children, it could be for themselves, it could be for their parents, then by and large, the individual with caregiving responsibilities can't agree ex ante to work whenever the person is asked to work, to fly to Tokyo every other weekend, to give up dinner times, to be there for the 11 o'clock on Friday meeting every Friday. So I think of that as that one member of the couple has to, at least one, has to be on call at home, even if they have a real full-time job. And that's where the problem lies, that if the greedy job pays that much more, the couple is being enticed to have one member in the greedy job and one member in the flexible job. And if these jobs pay that much different in terms of per hour, and if women are disproportionately in the flexible job, then you give rise to, that will give rise to gender inequality, essentially, put it mildly. If you have couple inequity, if you jettison couple inequity, you throw gender inequality under the bus with it.
And so what is the, I mean, how do we, how does society address that? And to what extent, and you know, maybe this is outside your portfolio, but to what extent does addressing it for this cohort of people who have graduated college, now around 50% in terms of women who have graduated college and are pursuing a career, how does society address that dynamic that you've just outlined, jobs that want more control essentially over their employees, pay more for that control, and that ends up inevitably implicating couple equity. But then how does a response, well, let's start with that. What's the response for that from a societal perspective?
Okay, so the first important thing, and this is true if you have a health problem or a problem with your house, is to diagnose it correctly. So if we see that there are differences in earnings between men and women, differences in promotions, differences in jobs, do we diagnose it as the notion that women don't compete well, they don't negotiate well, supervisors are biased. So the first important thing is to have the correct diagnosis. And if we diagnose it in the way in which we've just been talking about, then we're on the right road. Now, it may be that, quote, a solution is not an easy thing to invent, to produce, to come up with. But it is still the case that we're not trying to tweak with things that aren't going to give us much and are just going to waste. You know, is it the case that having managers and supervisors take de-biasing training, is that just a waste of money? So, okay.
So in other words, like a book that says you've got to be more forward in asking your boss for more money, or these bias, like these type of sort of non-structural changes are not up to the task if what we have is a structural problem.
Right, and I'm not saying that there is no sexual harassment, no real discrimination, and no bias. Right. I'm just saying that we can get rid of all of that, and we would still have this other thing, and it's going to be quite large. But the way in which we can get out of this is to make jobs more flexible in the sense of reducing the cost of flexibility, making flexible jobs more productive. And one of the silver linings of the pandemic, perhaps, is that You don't have to take that trip to Tokyo. You don't have to go to Zurich to sign the contract. These are jobs that people with caregiving responsibilities have not been able to take. And they may be jobs that we don't have to do anymore, that we don't have to have the individual allocate entire weeks or weekends to travel when they couldn't possibly do that if they had caregiving responsibilities. Another factor, which is very clear, is that I don't want to make individuals into commodities, but just having one good substitute for yourself gives you a lot of freedom. We can see that, for example, in certain physician practices, that having a team of pediatricians is good for the pediatrician, and it's also good for the parents of the child who gets sick when pediatrician number one isn't available.
But I mean, aren't the reforms that you're talking about, I mean, I'm not convinced that necessarily anything that is developed, during COVID in terms of not flying to Zurich or whatever it is really going to be durable ultimately. I think these entities are going to pursue their profits. If they find it more profitable to send someone to Zurich, they might ultimately do that, particularly if their competitor is sending somebody to Zurich, to do these things. Is there no government or societal type of things, or are we just like hoping that essentially these corporations or management or whoever it is finds it more profitable to not do X, Y, or Z?
First of all, I'm surprised that you don't think that we have entered a new normal. You know, there were many different technological adaptions that we could have made before, and we didn't. What happened was that we have had a coordinated equilibrium. I assure you that in the next 5 to 10 years, you will look back at this conversation and say you were wrong, that in fact, we have entered a new normal. And in fact, the firm that used to send everyone to Tokyo and spent a lot of money on hotels,
we really don't. But the fact is that we don't know what we're going to be looking back on.
Exactly right. We don't know. And therefore, I'm not going to say one way or the other. But I do think that we have entered what we might call right now just a new normal.
I suspect. I mean, I also think that there used to be messengers who would ride their bikes if I wanted to send something to Midtown from my office in Brooklyn. But that hasn't necessarily, and that has been replaced and I now email it, but that hasn't done anything in terms of what you refer to as greedy jobs. I mean, I think it's possible that people won't be taking as many trips to Zurich, but I'm not convinced that once one firm realizes that hey, wait a second, when we have people in here 5 days a week, our sales go up 5% or 10%. We're going to do that. And then a competing firm is going to see that. And then I think things could easily change back. Now, it's possible. Maybe these are durable. Maybe they're not durable in the way that we predict. But I guess what I'm saying is that other than hoping that this chance pandemic has altered the formulation for 50% of the female population, is there any things as a society that we can do that are not incumbent upon outside extraneous forces changing?
These aren't outside extraneous forces. These are individuals having their preferences revealed. These are not outside extraneous forces at all.
I guess. Okay?
So these are technological changes that always, these are technologies, Sam, that have always been out there. We just had a coordinated, there could have been an inherent desire to change, but you needed a coordinated equilibrium, and we just got a coordinated equilibrium. I think it's a fascinating change, and we could come up with lots of other examples where we had coordinated equilibrium, and then you said, gosh, there was such inertia, I didn't realize that I could get to the subway a different way. And now I realize that I'm in a better position. But there, remember that we're also thinking about whether men, fathers, have also a desire to spend more time with their children and will go to their workplaces and say, you want me to miss dinner every night? You want me to go to Zurich every other weekend? You know what? You're going to have to pay me so much more that you will think about changing your ways. End of story.
I hope you're right that people who are working have more power, but I can tell you, like, in the context of this office, for instance, I think if I was to ask Matt sitting over there, Matt, would you rather be at home right now, zooming in on this in a way that nobody would be aware? I think Matt would probably say yes. But I said to Matt, I don't know, a couple months ago, I want everybody in here because it changes the dynamic for me, and Matt's here. And so I think, like, the fundamental principle in my mind is that the capitalist class, the managerial class, whatever you want to say, ultimately is going to do what is in their most profit to them, and that we don't necessarily.
That's right. That's right. But Matt could say to you, yes, Sam, I just had a baby and I want to stay home. So if you want me to come in, you have to pay me three times as much. And Sam would say, you know, I don't know. Maybe you can come in every other day.
Maybe this Sam might be a little bit different, but let's say just like, let's generic Sam goes, bye, Matt.
That's right. That's right. And you know what? We aggregate that up. We have a supply curve. We have a demand curve. We come up with a new equilibrium. Okay. That's the way you have to think about it.
You want
someone to step in with a magic wand, Sam. There's no magic wand. Sorry.
I don't think there needs to be necessarily a magic wand, but I mean, we do, you know, there was a time where you didn't have 8-hour work days. There was a time where, you didn't have things like time and a half, like you didn't have a weekend. I mean, the government has shown that it actually can come in, not necessarily with a magic wand, but with like a stick.
What's the stick, Sam? I'm losing it. What's the stick?
I'm not sure what the answer is for this.
You just brought me back to the Fair Labor Standards Act. We have the Fair Labor Standards Act. So what changed?
I mean, I don't know. I could maybe come up with a couple of ideas. Maybe we have confiscatory taxation at a certain point, which discourages these things. Or maybe we restructure the way that compensation is. Or maybe we...
We restructure? Who's we?
We as a government.
The government restructures the compensation. The government can change tax rates. It can't restructure the compensation.
Well, I think I would argue that actually when we said that you're going to, if you get paid in stock, you get 20% less taxes, then yes, we restructured the compensation mechanism. I think I would argue that if we were to have single payer healthcare, we would restructure the compensation or if I was to say, you'd got to give 8 weeks paid leave, we would restructure compensation. Or if I was to say that, childcare is subsidized or we're going to do an expansion of the child tax credit. I mean, there's a lot of ways I think government can restructure compensation.
Well, that was where I was going to go with this. So there are three things that can be done. One has to do with the one that we're talking about, which is that substitution, reducing the price of flexibility, increasing the productivity of flexible jobs. That's a change in relative prices. The second one is changing the relative price of care. So increasing the availability, lowering the cost of pre-K programs, okay? Would we as a nation ever go further than that and increase or have subsidization for, in a Sweden-like manner, for child care itself of children, infants, one and over? I don't know. We can have a conversation about why we as a nation have not come together on something like that. Parental leave is completely different, by the way. So that's a different story entirely. And the third one, so we have two things that would change relative prices, the price of greedy work or flexible work, and the second one is the price of care. And the third is to try to change social norms. That's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, indeed. And so lastly, let me, what are the implications of any of these changes on women who pursue careers for the for folks who you you know are engaged in jobs and non-careers, I guess?
So there certainly is, in the sense that there was a great piece in the Times many months ago about Jamba Juice workers and the fact that, you know, we think that there are greedy jobs. There are also jobs in which you don't even know when you have to show up. In those jobs, if you're a single mom, they're hell because, you know, when do you need care for your kids? If you're a young person who wants to pursue advanced, you know, wants to finish your GED or get an associate's degree, when can you go to school? So yes, so the some aspects of greedy jobs trickle down to those employments as well.
And that's where I would whip out my magic wand and enforce some of those labor acts that say we need a written down schedule, and you need to give your employees 3 or 4 weeks notice as to what that schedule is, or maybe even 6 months or something to that effect. But
well, good luck.
Well, we're working on it. Claudia Golden, the professor of economics at Harvard University, author of Career and Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. Thanks so much for your time today.
Sam, and good to meet you, Emma.
Good to meet you as well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
I was going to say, we're going to put a link to that book at majority.fm. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It's what keeps Matt coming in here.
Yep.
It's like crack the whip. Matt, honestly, if I gave you the option, you know, are you turning red?
Oh, you know, no. I would definitely take a couple days a week.
Right. You'd be chilling at home fancy seat that you have back
there. I like
there.
To get the walk in. I like, I mean, I don't know much about the fancy seat, but I like the walk into work.
Your gaming seat.
Yeah, it sucks, though.
You're obsessed with his gaming chair. Right. And he
said it's bad.
He cheaped out. Right.
You got it. Well, because all the office chairs weren't available or stocked up. So I got a gaming chair, and the gaming chair is cheap because, you know, gamers don't really know.
You would
the finer things in life. They don't like padded armrests.
You would hate the like girly kind of velvet office chair I got for the new apartment, which my boyfriend hates too.
Guess what I'm getting you for Christmas this year?
Oh, wow.
Padded. I had to get one for my elbow. But
it's horrible.
But that's it. But folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And don't forget Majority Live.
The Big Live.
The Big Live is happening on January 16th in Boston, Massachusetts. On the bill, Natalie Scherr, John Benjamin, Larry Murphy. I'm conferring with Benjamin and Murphy this week, actually, at dinner. Over plants.
You're gonna put tell them what to do, and you're gonna plant some stuff.
Maybe.
All right.
I don't know. I'll wing it. We'll see. Folks, you can become. You can join us going to majoritylive.com or majorityreportlive.com. We're gonna have a ton of fun. We're gonna be vaxxed. We're gonna be masked. I don't know if we'll be masked on stage, but we're gonna take tests. You're going to take tests, right?
Oh, I thought you meant the whole auditorium. Yeah, no.
No, I'm not going to test the whole auditorium.
We'll take tests, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to get there early, so if you want to come get your test administered
Matt's,
by me,
Matt's
I'm
going to swab everybody.
Right at that nostril.
And folks, what better gift than a Majority Report scarf? Got a good scarf.
Yeah. I want
at shop.majorityreport.com.
I am a scarf person, and I walk to work in the middle of winter. That'll be nice.
Here is a tip for you young folks who don't wear scarves. Now, I know you do, but I didn't understand this until I was much older. You go out, you wear your coat, it's not heavy enough because that's the way you roll, right? You're a little tied into fashion, you want to look good, you're going out of the town. Scarf is the smallest piece of clothing that you can carry with you.
Yes.
That gives you the highest warmth factor you could get.
I mean, look at me. In the winter, I love my neck being warm, right? At all times.
Yeah, I wouldn't do a turtleneck.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's still a little constricting.
Yeah, I don't like that feeling.
I like it. And I'm better than you, so listen
Matt,
to me.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe to the extent that you can enter it because I hold you here?
For patreon.com/leftreckoning subscribers, we did a think tank this weekend talking about a whole bunch of questions, including the Jamal Bowman DSA stuff. On Wednesday, we have Tamanisha John joining us to talk about Barbados becoming the newest republic in the world and doing what everyone should do and get rid of the queen. That'll be at 8 o'clock Eastern. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel.
Can I do a spoiler alert? They did not, the DSA did not take any formal sanction against Jamal Bowman.
They didn't expel him, but they won't be endorsing him next time.
Oh, is that right?
That's my understanding.
I think that's a mistake, but okay. But well, whatever. I mean,
what did you say? The DSA
can do it, but I think that like,
but this isn't the DSA Palestine. So is this an overarching decision by like,
I think
DSA New York, too?
It's the DSA steering committee, I believe. They took a vote on it and voted not to expel. But my intent is they're not going to endorse next time either.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, you'll talk about it on Left Reckoning.
Yep.
Folks! Now, apparently my scarf comment was very, very controversial.
How? How so?
Baklava.
You're absolutely right about
balaclava.
This.
Balaclava.
I mean, I hate to be a
sucker. A balaclava. Could be a little bit better, but I don't think so. I don't think
what
so.
What the hell's a balaclava?
I'll explain at the break. Folks, join us in the fun half, 646-257-3920. See you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's, I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.